So I just want to welcome everyone to today's internet webcast on the bioavailability-based remediation of metals using soil amendments, considerations and evaluation techniques. And this seminar is part one in a two-part series. The second part will be, I believe the date is August 31st, and you can register for that at cluin.org. And this is kind of a follow-up to a session that we also sponsored in March on, ecological land reuse and doing remediation with soil amendments that Mark Springer and myself delivered before the National Association for Remedial Project Managers Conference. My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I am with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and I'm going to moderate today's session, which will start in a few minutes, but while we wait for others to log on, I'm just going to go over a few housekeeping items. So when you registered, you were directed to a seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. Now, if you were on the wait list, we asked you to use the PDF version of the slides, which I emailed out this morning. So you will be seeing the same things. It'll just be in the PDF version, not on the web. But basically, the first page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have bios of the presenters along with their contact information. And you can also note that the presenters' email addresses are hot links on this page. So if you have any questions for one of them after today's presentation, you can get in touch with them. And it's also on the seminar main page. Due to the large number of people that we expect to be participating in this webinar, I have globally muted everyone's phone line, and therefore we'll be accepting questions via the webcast, so you can hit the question mark button at the top of the at the top of your slides, and you'll get a box that comes up that will allow you to ask questions. So by now you all should have clicked on the agenda for today using the go-to session icon and be on slide number one of the presentation. And basically the main page contains the slides, above which you see some navigation icons which are an orange color and have some arrows and houses and question marks on them. And as I mentioned, you can submit a question by using the question mark icon that you see above the slide. And one thing to remember, you don't have to wait until we have a question and answer period in order to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit them in advance of the Q&A session, so we're ready to go when we pause to do that. Another thing I want you to know that if you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use the question mark icon to alert us to your technical difficulties you're encountering. We just ask that you include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we'll try to help you troubleshoot your problem. As the presenter moves along, they will be announcing what slide number they are on, and you can click to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide, or you can click on the appropriate slide number that's in the left-hand frame of your screen. So we will take time to answer your questions. At the end of the presentation, you'll find some links to additional resources. And these things stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access them after the presentation. One thing you should know that we typically place our seminars in an archive with a soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And usually that takes about 2 weeks, and you'll receive an email when it's ready. We also have a feedback form on the links page at the end of the presentation, and I do encourage you to complete that as we do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and the delivery of our seminars. So I think we're ready to get started. You can move to slide three at this time. And today we're going to have three speakers. The first is Mark Springer, who's with EPA's Superfund program, ERT, and then myself, Michelle Mahoney, and then we also have Rufus Cheney, who's with USDA ARS. But Mark is going to do an introduction to our session, and then I'll follow up with some tools and resources, and then Rufus will get into the meat of the presentation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark.
Okay. Thank you very much. As you said, indicated, I'm with the Superfund program, and that's going to, why that's important is my perspective on this is mainly from site remediation perspective, both removal and remedial, and why this whole area of soil amendments is important to us and why we should be looking at this. If you can move to slide 4. We have a tremendous number of sites that are mining impact and impacted and metals impacted across the country. They are not just mining sites, but other mining-related sites, things like iron production sites. And we need to find a way of economically, feasibly doing things with these sites, and they present a great number of problems for us. The old default mechanism of dealing with them, either capping them or digging up the material and placing it in a repository or a landfill someplace, is just not always feasible or economical. And we need some other tools to use to select not only protective remedies, but cost-effective remedies. And that's kind of my perspective on this. So if we go to slide 5, what are the effects of on these impacted lands? I'm trying to use generic terms versus slag or other types of specific things, but mining impacted, metals impacted lands. Typically, we can have a loss of topsoil. We can have a loss of soil functions or other losses of use of those properties. Perhaps they can't be used for the agricultural use that we would like them to use them for or some other aspect. These impacts can result from physical loss of soil. So you'll see some of these sites, there effectively isn't soil left. Or we could be losing the soil structure from toxicity or some other mechanism. And these are not necessarily restricted just to the United States. The issue of soil functioning and loss of use and bringing soils into a functional use is worldwide. Go to slide 6. Just for those of you who may not have seen some of these sites and get a picture for some of the scales of what we're talking about, just have a few slides to sort of give you a feel for the kinds of places that we have to deal with. On the top left is a picture of the Bunker Hill site or a portion of it below Kellogg. It's actually West Page Swamp, which is in the lower portion of that photograph. The upper right-hand picture is actually a push-out pad at 11,000 feet at a site called Standard Mine. To be honest, I can't remember the name of the site in the lower left-hand soil site, but you can see it's much smaller. It's just some waste material that's eroding down into a stream bed. This kind of site is not uncommon. Or in the lower right-hand corner, this picture of Midnight Mine, which is a uranium mine in the state of Washington on the Spokane Reservation. And you can see this mine, and if your eyes are really good, you can see off in the distance some other relatively bare patches, and those are other mining sites within the area. Slide 7, some other examples. The upper left is a portion of the mining in the Tri-State Lead Mining District out near Jasper. And Oklahoma in the Tar Creek site. The upper right is iron slag from a mining operation in Sharon, Pennsylvania, or a iron production. You'll see more pictures of the one in the lower left. This is Palmerton Zinc in Pennsylvania. And the lower right is tailings deposits along the upper Arkansas River in near Leadville, Colorado. Slide 8. As I said, you know, there's impacts from a variety of things. You can see the upper left-hand picture is again in Leadville, and you can see the salt crystals forming. There's toxicity associated with this. Effects of the high salinity just of the salts. The picture on the upper right is again at the California Gulch site along the upper Arkansas, where we have tailings again. They are fine material, low pH, no productivity, and we need ways to evaluate this. The lower picture is in New Mexico in National Forest, a small mining site. So these sites are not necessarily, the point is that the sites are not necessarily restricted to big Superfund sites. There's a lot of mining impacted sites that are remote, up in the mountains and national forests. Some of them are actually in or adjacent to national parks, in specifically national monuments. And they take all forms, either the waste materials or even remnants of processing. The lower right-hand picture was from a site called Lead Silver. That was a heap leach pad that was left for gold recovery using cyanide extraction. So, slide 9. Because of the scale of these sites, we need to improve our ability to evaluate the risk. Why do we need to evaluate the risk? We need to evaluate the risk so we know what we're trying to remediate. Are we trying to remediate physical impacts? Are we trying to remediate zinc toxicity? Are we trying to remediate lead toxicity? They're going to be different, and we need to make sure that we're remediating the risks that are important at the site versus just doing something to make it look good. And that has always been the criticism of soil amendment technologies, is that we were not necessarily fixing the entire problem. Slide 10. So basically, risk. What is risk? Risk is exposure times hazard. That's what risk is. So you need exposure and you need a hazard. Risk assessment, we're always trying to evaluate these things. And in metal sites, both things can be changing, and that's the basis of amendment technology, is changing the exposure and changing the degree of hazard, because for metals, the hazard is determined by the chemical form of the metal, not necessarily the presence. But we're always trying to look at ways of making these evaluations and doing it better than we have before, making it more accurate versus using default assumptions. So for example, trying to evaluate exposure in a human health risk assessment, we may do something like a market basket survey where we go out and we look at what people are eating to determine what the dietary exposure would be from different things that they are consuming, whether they're collecting wild produce, wild rice, wild carrots, something of that nature. They're doing hunting, they're doing fishing, or perhaps just residential exposure in the yard. We're trying to figure out what those exposures are. In ecological risk, we can conduct field studies. We can go out and we can collect organisms and measure the actual accumulation and get a handle on what the actual exposures are. In both instances, what we're trying to do is get site-specific, location-specific information on the bioavailability or the bioaccessibility related to the actual exposure. And it's not always a very easy thing to do, and as I said, with these mining sites, we're trying to change that. So we need ways to assess what it was and what it's going to become to see that we're doing a remedy that is actually doing what we want it to do. Slide 12. This is just a slide to relate to a document, which is the framework for metals risk assessment. And basically the only point of this slide is that it's noted within the EPA guidance documents that metals form and exposure changes and are critical in evaluating the actual exposure and the actual toxicity, the actual risk that's posed. One of the key things to remember with many, not necessarily all, but many of the technologies that will be discussed in this presentation and in the future one, don't necessarily change the absolute concentration in the media that we're remediating. We're changing the exposure through other mechanisms, and we have to be more sophisticated about doing that and being positive that we are actually doing the correct thing. Slide 13. So, we have a big problem, lots of sites all over the place, remote locations, difficult to get to, logistically difficult to get to. We have the idea of we want to have sustainable remediation. We don't necessarily want to rip up another terrestrial system to harvest topsoil to cover another problem. We don't necessarily want to take waste material from one location, move it to another location and put it in a repository, or just simply impacting another location. We're hoping that the net benefit is positive, but maybe there are better ways to do this and accomplish the protective remedy we're required to get, but also do minimize the amount of impact that we do to other areas, as well as decreasing the cost. But in order to do that, we need to make sure that we're using these techniques correctly. And that is one of the biggest dangers with new technology is that they are misapplied. And people think they're doing the right thing. They do it very well with well intentions. However, we need to make sure that we are, in fact, doing the right thing and that we are applying these technologies correctly. And where we do apply it, it is appropriate. With that, I will turn it over to Michelle.
Great. Thank you, Mark. The next few slides, I'm just going to show you some tools that are available to get more in-depth information about EPA's work in ecological land reuse and using soil amendments. And particularly for this audience, I just want to let you make sure you're aware of our EcoTools webpage on CLUIN, where we do have a focus area on soil amendments, and you'll find lots of case studies where we've used this technology and just lots of tools and information that can help you if you have some questions in the future. And another thing we'll mention is on the main page of this website, we do have a spotlight area, so as new information comes out, you know, we post it right up there. If we have new publications or if we created a video or a new case study, you would know about it right away if you go to this main web page. Now we're moving to slide 16. Another thing I want you to know, you'll be able to find all of our archived internet seminars and presentations on this web page, including the one that you're on right now. And like I mentioned in my introduction, you will get an email when this presentation is available for future playback. We also have presentations that we've given at conferences and trainings and the variety of different speakers and site managers that talk about doing this work at their site and their lessons learned and, you know, how they got to their final ecological land reuse. Slide 16, I just wanted to show you a variety of some fact sheets that we have for more information. We do have a whole fact sheet. It's a two-page fact sheet. This is the first one on the left on using soil amendments and how you can get assistance and find more information. We also have a database of all the sites that have been put into ecological reuse. And, you know, if they did use soil amendments, what did they use? What were any lessons learned? And who's a contact? And then our newest fact sheet is on growing gardens and urban soils, and I know Rufus is going to touch on this subject a little bit in his presentation, too. On slide 17, I just provide a little bit more information here on our Eco Restoration Project Profiles database that I mentioned in the previous slide, where you can find more specific information about, you know, all the sites that we know of that have used this type of technology to land. To get their land into reuse. And on slide 18, I wanted to show you a paper that was written by coordination with my office called The Use of Soil Amendments for Remediation, Revitalization, and Reuse. And this paper has a lot of useful tables about the types of contaminants that can be addressed using soil amendments, what type of soil amendments, and what types of sites that we have experience with in using soil amendments for remediation. So you'll find a lot of useful information there that can help you maybe solve some problems at your sites. And then slide 19, this is just site-specific support that my office can provide. You know, we can help you with a variety of different things with your sites. Mark and I are working on a bunch of sites together now. I have an interagency agreement with Rufus Cheney, who's going to speak next, and we're working on a few sites together, basically putting in some test plots, figuring out what soil amendments are the right mix, what, you know, what do you want to plant at that site. And Rufus, you know, Rufus has a lab where we can do some pot studies. And with that, the next slide is just my contact information. If you have any questions related to, you know, anything that you hear today and or you just want to talk more about how we can help you with your site, feel free to contact me. So with that, if you move to slide 21, we'll start with Rufus's presentation. I just want to mention again to everyone, if you do have questions as we're moving through the presentation, you can hit the question mark icon at the top of your slides and then submit a question electronically. So I'm very happy to present Rufus Cheney, who's a senior research agronomist, at USDA ARS in Beltsville, Maryland. He conducts research on the fate, food chain transfer, and potential effects and remediation of hazards from soil microelements. And I know that I'm very excited to know Rufus and work with Rufus, and I'm excited for him to present his information on bioavailability of metals. So with that, Rufus, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Michelle. My goal today is to illustrate how soil amendments, risk assessment, understanding phyto and bioavailability are used in achieving remediation of toxic soils. That was 21. Slide 22 describes how I see the problem, very much like Mark did. I mean, we worked with Mark on a number of sites and with other EPA researchers, and we come to sites, and I'll show you a few in a minute, that are barren, 1,000-acre dead soils. Often they're mine waste or smelter contaminated areas, or maybe an area where mine waste contaminated river sediments were put up on land. And then as sulfide oxidizes, it becomes extremely toxic, zinc toxic usually. Many of these sites are rich in trace elements from contaminated mineral sources. Zinc is the most common, but copper, nickel, manganese, and cobalt sites also are known. Risk can occur through soil ingestion primarily rather than toxicity to plants. That would be for lead, arsenic, and fluoride. Risk can be mostly through the food chain for cadmium, molybdenum, cobalt, rather than toxicity to plants or toxicity through soil ingestion. This acidification is a key part. I mean, there are parts of the United States that are still remain highly alkaline, and so the zinc is hardly ever toxic there. There are areas in the Northeast and the far West where rainfall over millennia has greatly acidified. When heavy metals fell down on the soils around the Palmerton smelter, the soils end up at pH 4.5 or even below that with thousands of parts per million of zinc, and nothing can live in those circumstances. So the need to remediate these sites is to reduce the bioavailability. We have to understand risk, as Mark said, we have to understand it in terms of how to change bioavailability, phytoavailability, bioaccessibility to organisms, wildlife, or people that ingest soil that's contaminated. The next slide, 23, is Palmerton in 1980 when I first went there. I mean, there's well over 1,000 acres that were killed by combination of metal discharge and fire and then eroded, so there's hardly any soil left. At the Bunker Hill Superfund site, there's 3,000 acres. This is the delightful Bunker Hill, the round hill in the background. It was terraced in 1970. This was the late 90s and still totally barren. I went backwards myself here. The next slide is that California Gulch site. This is Chuck Henry from University of Washington, who worked with Sally Brown and me, and Harry Compton and the group ERT group, to remediate that site, and Mark did the ecological assessment of the remediation. Here's a dead site from riverine sediments deposited on the side. They were rich in sulfide, oxidized, became pH 2.5, 1% zinc. He showed you the zinc sulfate that accumulates on the surface in the summertime. This is just an absolutely dead site. Adjacent land owned by a rancher actually harmed horses, much like the harm at Palmerton. The next slide, that's 26, shows an asbestos mine waste site in northern Vermont, and I'll show you some more at toward the end of the talk. Here's, again, 300 acres. It's been dead since at least 1950. In this case, it's not toxicity, but infertility. That's why we have to try to understand what's really going on at these sites so we can revegetate. Slide 27 shows an urban garden site. Urban gardens may be highly contaminated. They may or may not be toxic to plants. Depends upon pH and use of organic matter amendments over the years and so on. But risk assessment for lead and maybe other things needs to be done for many inner city gardens or wherever there was building demolished before it became a garden. I'm sorry, I lost my sight for a second. 27, 28. So, again, summarizing the problem, looking at it technically. Where we have metal problems, there's almost always low soil pH, which allows zinc or copper or nickel to be soluble enough to harm, kill plants, or do other things. So how do we solve that? We make the site alkaline. We make it calcareous deliberately. Sometimes if we make the site calcareous, we actually induce manganese deficiency. So I had a site in Canada where we had to add manganese fertilizer along with limestone so the site remained fertile. But I could completely reverse severe nickel toxicity by limestone and fertilizer. Almost all of these sites that have been polluted may have become barren. They erode their surface organic matter with all the nutrients bound up in the organic layer. And so the sites are severely deficient in nitrogen and phosphorus, may even be deficient in the microelements needed to grow plants. On a site with lead toxicity, as you'll hear at the next seminar, we have to usually add a high amount of phosphorus to convert the lead into pyromorphite so it's no longer so dangerous by soil ingestion. We also almost always need to add phosphorus so that it's high in pea fertility so legumes can grow on a site. Why do I say legumes? Because we got to have nature provide fixed nitrogen in order for a site to stay green. There are metal-tolerant grasses, but no metal-tolerant legumes. And so we have to remove the toxicity so the legumes thrive, so we have a stable ecological site after we're done vegetating it to regarding the metals and grasses, for instance. Sometimes we need more iron, either as a fertilizer or as adsorbent. I'm very much in favor of iron-rich materials. Iron and steel slag and biosolids and ironized manures, something to increase metal adsorption by the improved soil. Another thing that engineers don't usually think about is the key role of soil microbes. Soils are live. If we don't, when they become barren from metal toxicity, it may kill all the microbes too. The site that Mark mentioned, the West Page Swamp, it was pH 2 and 1% zinc or more. It was so toxic that even when it was made neutral pH and flooded, it would not become reducing because the bugs were all killed by the zinc. So one way to reestablish a good, diverse microbial population is a compost. We who have worked on contaminated sites love compost, manure compost, leaf compost, biosolids compost, mixtures of materials as compost, because they give us, again, living organic matter, improves the rooting zone for soil, for plants, provides a diverse microbial inoculum so that we can have the functions of soil. So the solutions on the next slide, 29, the solutions are find an inexpensive, locally available lime-rich material. Often byproducts are lime-rich. We've used sugar beet lime, we've used acetylene lime, we've used coarse lime, a number of different materials are available. I just found a source of a calcium silicate-rich steel slag that becomes as good as calcium carbonate. It's 90% calcium carbonate if you analyze it. But we need alkalinity, and we need excess alkalinity, so the site is made calcareous, pH 7.5 with maybe as much as 5% calcium carbonate equivalent after you're done, so that it is protected for hundreds of years against any decline in pH. So there won't be future problems from those metals. As I mentioned before, increasing the metal adsorption by iron and manganese oxides or organic matter are very useful. that provides a persistent reduction in the bioavailability to organisms and plants of these soil metals. As I said before, you got to be able to grow legumes on the remediated sites. So high pH and high phosphorus are absolutely critical. We have to achieve food chain protection. In the case of cadmium, we can do that because nearly every site has more than 100 times more zinc than cadmium, so the zinc will kill the plant before the plant cadmium is dangerous to the consumer. If it's high in fluoride, we've got to deal with that. If it's high in lead, we've got to deal with that by the phosphate and organic matter method I mentioned earlier. Another point of view of cover in regard to wildlife exposure is that when you have a good effective plant cover, things can't eat soil nearly as easily. Eating soil is the dominant risk of lead, arsenic, and fluoride. The next slide, that's 30, again summarizes this idea that Michelle mentioned in the soil amendments booklet, is coming up with inventive, locally available mixtures of remediation ingredients. So you can do what I call a one-shot remediation. We can mix compost and limestone and other fertilizers if they're needed in a central mixing spot and then place those on the site for either incorporation or surface application. And so it's a matter of using our imagination and the commercial networks to find biosolids and compost, yard debris, MSW, manure, agricultural byproducts that include quite complicated compost from manure and crop residues and food processing waste. There can be silicate-rich byproducts, coal combustion residues sometimes. For instance, I'm using gypsum in the Vermont Superfund site because it's an asbestos site and severely deficient in calcium. So FTD gypsum is a natural amendment for a site like that. So we used wood ash in another case, several kinds of waste lime. Fly ash was used at Palmerton. It's, again, using our professional creativity to look for inexpensive, or they'll pay you to take it, materials that would make a good remediation mixture, preparing that mixture, applying on the surface, which I'll explain in a minute, or incorporating. The next slide, 31, just says that again. All we got to do is make it calcareous, solve the fertility problems, use our knowledge to alleviate the bioavailable metal residues that would interfere with plants, microbes, or poison wildlife or livestock. A single treatment for a comprehensive remediation. That's the goal, and it's been found to be doable everywhere we've looked. Slide 32 is a big picture model of metals and soil focused on nickel, because I've worked at nickel sites that were owned by International Nickel Company in Canada. The soil solution, soluble nickel, the chemical activity of free nickel 2+, is what poisons things. But the activity of nickel 2+ is highly dependent upon the composition of the soil and the soil pH. The nickel can be present bound to the organic matter. Humic or fulvic acid can be bound to iron and manganese oxides, or actually incorporated inside them. We call that occluded in the oxides. They can be in inorganic forms. There's a nickel oxide that's emitted from smelters, which is kinetically inert. It's not toxic. It doesn't dissolve. It's got a half-life of 20 years before it's half converted to nickel in equilibrium with the soil. But then there's a nickel silicate, which can be very unavailable. And there's a whole new class of nickel minerals. They're called layered double hydroxides with aluminum. And then where silicate fills into that mineral over time, it becomes less and less potentially dissolvable, even if you acidify the site in the future. So this whole new class of metal forms, these layered double hydroxides with zinc and nickel and cobalt, can be formed by our treatments and then make the metals in very unavailable form and remove the toxicity risk. Of course, the metals can harm plants, they can harm soil microbes, and if the soil is ingested, if it's soluble still, it can harm the consumer. The next slide lists what I call the soil-plant barrier idea. That is, for nearly all elements, the metal is so insoluble or strongly bound by the soil that it's not practically taken up. things like chromium and lead and iron and mercury and tin and silver and zirconium and goes on, are not practically absorbed by plants. Plant-to-soil ratio is less than 0.01. So that is not the basis for risk for those elements. Another group of elements, the second group, are phytotoxic, that is, it kills plants, before the plant is dangerous to the wildlife that might eat it as 100% of their diet or the livestock. So in that case, again, zinc and copper and nickel and arsenic, manganese, boron, fluoride are not poisonous through plant uptake. They can only be poisonous by these other roots, in particular, soil ingestion, which is the fourth item there. Soil ingestion breaks this soil-plant barrier. There's very few elements which are taken up by plants at high enough concentration in the plant that they could harm wildlife or livestock, and that's limited to cobalt, selenium, and molybdenum. The next slide, 34, deals with issues of raising soil pH. When you get a soil that's been oxidized sulfide and lowered to pH 2, you've got a huge amount of exchangeable and soluble aluminum you've got to precipitate before the pH is going to rise much at all. Further, limestone can only react quickly in the depth of its incorporation. When you put calcium carbonate on the surface, or calcium hydroxide on the surface, it can only react in 10 to 20 years to the top centimeter. Only tillage can incorporate that. Where you've got a deep site rather than a surface contaminated site, you may have to incorporate limestone to the depth of metal toxic concentration. For instance, at that California Gulf site at Leadville, there were 2 feet of alluvial deposit that was pH 2.5. Only by incorporating the limestone with construction equipment were we able to neutralize the deep acidity. Other sites, you can neutralize it using a trick that we found, which is combining biodegradable organic matter with the alkaline material. During the biodegradation, the calcium can react with organic breakdown products, and the calcium chelate can move down in the soil and be oxidized by microbes deeper in, and then essentially deposits alkalinity deeper in the soil. And I'll show you how that worked at several sites. The finer the lime material, the quicker the reaction. But we can't make surface applied calcium carbonate or calcium hydroxide do the job. Calcium silicate can be leachable. Calcium sulfate can be leachable, but it doesn't move alkalinity down. It actually acidifies the soil. So each one of these has its own unique properties that affect its use of remediation. The next slide, 35, shows what happened in a set of experimental plots where biosolid compost, rich in limestone, was applied on a soil here at Beltsville. The left-hand graph line is the control soil, and even with carbonate applied on the surface, it stays extremely acidic. But on the right-hand part of the graph, where the alkalinity was applied in the biosolids, the pH became alkaline all the way below 80 centimeters. The next slide is the same kind of thing with a different soil, a finer soil, a fine sandy loam, and the limestone can't move as quickly or easily in a sandy loam as it does in a sand, and even slower in a clay, and so that has to be taken into account about leaching of alkalinity. In this case, you'll see that different rates of application. For instance, the triangles, upside-down triangles, show near the maximum alkalinity movement to depth. The next slide is where different kinds of biosolids, a compost, raw biosolids. You'll see that the undigested or raw biosolids line caused much more leaching of alkalinity because it has much more biodegradation going on in the few years after it was applied. But all of them are far higher pH than the control soil and well below the surface. So we can achieve lime movement below the surface by combining biodegradable organic matter with limestone equivalent. The next slide has to do with lead reactivity. lead Superfund sites and urban soils rich in lead can be a risk to children. We did a study, Sally Brown et al. Did a study with a soil from a Baltimore urban lawn. We incorporated different biosolids, incubated them to equilibrate for a month, and then fed that soil to rats to us to actually measure the bioavailability. The next slide, 39, shows the soil and bone lead. You'll see that the two I have in green reduce the bone lead by more than 50% just because we incorporated a biosolid compost, the compost from either D.C. or Baltimore, into those soils. Those composts are very rich in iron, which can bind metals, and they're and alkalinity, which can help reduce, and high in phosphate, which can force or encourage or cause the formation of lead pyromorphite, which is a low bioavailability form of lead. The next point on the next slide I want to raise is the issue of, again, to show you rather than just tell you that when you have a low ratio of cadmium to zinc, as you do in biosolids, I show here three different biosolids compared to control where I grew Swiss chard, a leafy vegetable. The third line of crop, the pH was acid there, and so I had the five times higher cadmium in the crop than the control. But you see, it was also very high in zinc. And look at the kidney and liver. You'll see that there was no increase in kidney or liver cadmium because the zinc in the food reduces the absorption of cadmium in the intestine. And this has been confirmed in cattle and in mice feeding studies with other with lettuce and a number of other research programs that you can end up with essentially no cadmium risk if it's this 100-to-1 and you have avoided zinc toxicity. Now let's go to the next slide, which is 41, and start showing you the Palmerton remediation picture. As I showed initially, Palmerton has hundreds and hundreds of acres of dead earth, eroded rock with the soil between the rocks. It's just it's a horrible site. It still is in much of the area that has not been legally addressed at all. This was 1980. The next slide is a false image where we did a new paper last year, Beyer et al. And again, it shows the wide area which has very poor vegetative cover. The vegetation is shown in pink. The next slide is looking at a farmer's field. We went there because the farmer had horses killed by the deposition before they closed the smelter in 1983. And the mountain is in the background. The next slide, 41.4, is the dead pony. They're poisoned by zinc. It ruins the cartilage in their bones. The next slide is the bone with no cartilage in the joint. It really is it's a horrible thing. And it is the adverse effect on wildlife or livestock of excessive zinc from the food chain point of view. It doesn't happen except when there is deposition still going on. Slide 46 is in the borough of Palmerton. All these people lived in an area where the soils were above 1% zinc, 10,000 ppm. And, you know, with that kind of level of metals, if you don't make it calcareous and add organic matter, you end up not being able to grow grass on your lawn. And then your kids carry mud in the house, you get tired about that, and you cover your lawn with grass or mulch of different kinds, or put concrete instead of a lawn. It's just it was a difficult situation. The next slide is just looking at that mountainside across from the smelter proper before they began remediation back in 1980. The next slide after that is a home garden adjacent to the railroad track right beside the place. And then slide 50 is radishes suffering zinc toxicity. I mean, hardly anything can grow, although by adding enough limestone and manure, people could grow gardens in that area. The next slide is showing another spot on another hill looking at the mountain across the way, the Blue Mountain. And there have been considerable revegetation done by the Horsehead Development Corporation using a mixture of biosolids, fly ash, and limestone thrown on the mountainside, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But in the foreground is area that was not owned by the polluter and nobody had done anything about, and it has remained barren, and it's barren today. The next slide shows, 51, shows the first field test of this mixture of biosolids, fly ash, and limestone, and using a metal-tolerant Merlin Ridge fescue. And adjacent to that, of course, is this barren earth material on the mountainside of Blue Mountain. At the edge, it was seeded. Ain't nothing growing because it's so toxic still. That soil was 1 to 4% zinc. It was pH 6 because of the zinc oxide that was deposited, but it's so high in zinc that it's severely toxic. And, of course, the cadmium and lead are high as well. The next slide is an overview from up on the mountain of this revegetated area done by the company. There's now a fairly diverse vegetative cover. And then the slide after that is an area that doesn't have bushes yet, but it has intermediate wheatgrass and lespediza that give a very effective cover. The toxicity was remediated so well that it is windblown seed have taken over. There's just so many different species. And then it's become a mecca for small mammals, mice and voles and shrews, and then for falcons and eagles and so on. It's a diverse ecosystem, and Mark Spranger has actually done research there and failed. He confirmed that there was no adverse effects on the wildlife. The next slide, 55, is a picture looking up on the mountain, and at the top, this is delightful control. That's the Appalachian Trail. And the government insisted that the company apply no biosolids within 100 meters of the Appalachian Trail. So we've got a natural dead still site at the top because they couldn't apply this biosolids remediation. Again, it was a mixture of alkalinity and biosolids, rich in iron and so on, that did that job. The next slide is just a pretty picture taken by a photographer in a revegetated area, again showing a lush vegetation. And 57 shows two key people in developing these ideas. John Euler on the right worked for a Horsehead after he worked for the NRCS Plant Development Center. The guy on the left is Tom Stepczynski from Poland, who took this idea and showed it in Poland, and then we brought it back to the United States, and I'll show you the things we did back in the United States. Now, the next slide, 58, shows you some of the chemistry and the change in bioavailability that are how we can show that we've made the remediation effect. Again, this site, I installed a set of tests for lawn grasses, among other things. And so I had limestone and fertilizer versus the biosolid compost compared to a control that had NPK fertilizer but no limestone. The soils all had 1.5 to 1.6% zinc. Delightfully contaminated, 1% cadmium of zinc, less than 1,000 lead. I looked at the DHP extractable, and you'll see that it's a huge amount of extractable zinc. And I have the green note at the bottom is an important point. When using chemical extraction methods to assess the phytoavailability of metals, like a DDPA method, you can actually saturate the DDPA if you use the standard method of 10 grams to 20 milliliters. That was saturated, would have only shown you about 1,000 ppm of DTPA zinc. By going to the higher solution to soil ratio, that is 5 grams to 50 mils, we were beyond the point where the chelating agent was saturated, and we got nearly 5,000 ppm of extractable. You see that the zinc and cadmium remained extractable even after it had been made calcareous. The next slide, though, shows you what happened to the soluble zinc. This is the strontium nitrate. It's 0.01 molar strontium nitrate extractable zinc and cadmium. You'll see that the lime sludge compost, rich in iron, reduced it from 195 ppm of strontium nitrate extractable zinc to 4.8. Non-toxic, as I'll show you in a minute. The cadmium was similarly greatly reduced in soluble amount. The pH was raised from 5.9 to 7.2, which is the calcareous pH. Look also on the right, the oxalate extractable, or the amorphous iron, was greatly increased by adding that biosolid compost rich in iron. The manganese would increase a little bit too, but the idea that we've increased the absorbent power, and by having it buffered at pH 7 or above by the limestone equivalent, we've made it much more effective as a metal absorbent. The next slide is showing the plots we put in. You'll see that there's a couple of bare spots. Those are the control treatment where the normal grasses simply died. The next slide, that's 61, shows later in that season the where the young woman is sitting is the control treatment, and you'll see that three or four of the blocks there are dead. That was tall fescue and bluegrass could not survive on that treatment, whereas the green square is the Merlin red fescue, the zinc tolerant grass. But in the background is the compost treated, and there all of the grasses are doing just fine, just fine. The next slide actually shows the concentration of zinc and cadmium in the different grasses. On the right is the control, and you see again, there's only the Merlin red fescue alive, and it has lower than phytotoxic amount of zinc. And the other two treatments, particularly with the compost to biosolids, we've got fairly high zinc, but it is not at a phytotoxic concentration, much lower because it wasn't killing the crop. And the paper shows more of those details. So by reducing the phyto or bioavailability by this treatment, I now can establish a diverse plant cover so that there's no limitation of keeping the soil in place. The next slide shows you what happens if you don't do anything. This was 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, when we were up there sampling some forest vegetation on the Appalachian Trail. It is still delightfully dead. The next slide after that is another view, seeing the other area in the background. You see that these dead logs and so on, those have been there since 1970, maybe even earlier. There's no microbes, no soil organisms to eat up the dead logs even. So it remains a dead ecosystem that we can easily cure by making it so that plants can grow there. The next slide, that's 65, is some of the volunteer occasional plants that are growing there. This is an oak, and it is sassafras, and it's got severe zinc poisoning, so anything that's up there is suffering from zinc toxicity. The next slide is coming back, that's 66, coming back to this idea of why and how go about this, what we think is the inexpensive, simple, sensible way to use soil amendments to remediate by changing bioavailability of soil contaminants. As I described, the components like iron oxide, amorphous iron oxide, phosphate, can increase metal binding and precipitation. Can change lead, zinc, copper, and other metal bioavailability very substantially. Combining limestone and biodegradable organic matter can leach alkalinity down the soil so you can actually surface apply. At Palmerton, all those were surface applied on the mountainside. My plots, I incorporated 10 centimeters. But on the mountain, those were just surface applied amendments because you can't rototill a stony mountainside. You have to face up to that kind of reality. Coming down that slide, the reason we want an excess of limestone, more than enough limestone, is so that we end up at pH 7.5, so it's going to remain alkaline for, again, centuries if we do our jobs right. Because we've added the organic matter, we then have the soil microbes, and we can have nutrient storage and bioavailability to maintain plants, a diverse plant cover. And by taking into account all of these ideas, we make what I've called a tailor-made remediation mixture, organic matter, absorbent, organic nitrogen, organic matter, microbial inoculum, energy for the microbes and the plants, and all of the nutrients needed to maintain a stable ecosystem. And because we're using byproducts and waste materials, it can be very inexpensive. It's clearly a public benefit. It often or usually found to be an extremely friendly practice, and public has shown this, and they say, when can we start? The next slide is how we do that, but we use our common sense. Some of you out there are engineering firms or people with these problems. All you got to do is go on the web, go to your phone book, talk to your NRCS people, your agricultural extension agent. Look for commercial compost suppliers, biosolid suppliers, woody waste suppliers, fly ash, wood ash suppliers. Find the sources and then make them into a mixture that does the job of achieving the goals that I've described in the rest of this talk. By the time you've learned why it works, you can become an effective communicator and help the people who are going to be watching this understand how good a choice this can be. It has worked very well, as I showed you before. So now we're going to go on to another illustration. That is the Kellogg, that is 68, the Kellogg, Idaho Superfund site, Bunker Hill. It's a delightful site. You can see that this has been, as I said, terraced in 70 and still dead, waiting an agronomist. Now the next slide, 69, is the application vehicle, an aero spreader that was used, that Chuck Henry found to use on this experiment going up the levees, or the terraces. But it gives you a kind of a scale. That's a large piece of equipment up there on the mountainside. The next slide, come on, go ahead, please. 70, Seventy is this machine throwing biosolids. It throws this semi-solid mixture to the side up to 200 feet. So, and an experienced applicator can make it 1 inch deep or 2 inches deep and make it pretty even if the site was even. The next slide is what later, both the foreground and the background were seeded, and where we applied that mixture, we've got diverse vegetated cover. Actually has lots of weeds that are volunteer, what we call the seed rain, the wind-blown seeds that come in that can't live until you remediate the zinc toxicity and supply the nutrients so that plants can germinate and actually live. The foreground, again, was seeded and fertilized, but it is dead and remains dead. The next slide is putting the same kind of test on the mountainside. Wherever we applied this mixture, even on this very steep slope, there's nice vegetative cover, persistent. We went back 2 years later, quite delightful, and the adjacent seeded, so it remained entirely barren. The next slide talks about Page Swamp. This swamp was a wetland constructed in mine waste deposit area. Somebody thought it'd be a great idea to make a wetland there, but when they established, they flooded it, nothing grew. It was so acid and so toxic that the microbes, as I said before, the microbes were not reducing, and it remained not anaerobic. Therefore, sulfide was not formed, and metals remained in the soluble form in the soil. In cooperation with that ERT program, Chuck Henry, Sally Brown, and our team put in this test of, again, biosolids, compost plus alkaline byproducts. And when that mixture was applied, the alkalinity immediately converted it into a non-toxic environment and gave a microbial inoculum. It became reducing. The lead was converted to lead sulfide, and the zinc was bound and converted, and it was non-toxic, and it became a thriving site. So the next slide shows the applying of that in the wetland. And the slide after that is one that Mark showed, and then the slide after that, 76, is this lush, diverse vegetative cover a few months after the application of the compost, and the lime equivalent. So that's another site with a perfectly effective vegetative cover that solved the ecosystem risk and converted it into a non-toxic, persistently stable site. The next slide, 77, is I'm going to show you something about a nickel site I did in Canada. You know, Canada has the famous Sudbury site where there's 10 miles of dead earth. They had another site on Lake Erie where there was some toxicity, but it wasn't so alkaline. But in that site, it was very low in manganese, so if you did add limestone to cure the nickel toxicity, you actually made it manganese deficient and killed the plants again. So we studied that process and used this combination of limestone and manganese fertilizer and other needed fertilizers to test the vegetation and grew different plants. I'm going to show you a few plants. Again, the manganese was applied to prevent deficiency. We simply grew them, analyzed the plants, and used this sorption nitrate extraction to measure the phytoavailable soil nickel. The slide after that shows you the change in the strontium nitrate extractable nickel. Before treatment, it was 57 ppm, initial pH 5.2. Then going to slide 80, you'll see that as we raise the pH with limestone, we have a delightful smooth reduction across the pH, going down to 2 to 3 ppm of strontium nitrate or water-soluble nickel. As long as the metal binding phase is there, from either the soil material or the amendment, raising the pH converts the metals into bound forms that are not toxic. The next slide, 81, is the response to the control, limed, and alkaline with snaptines. You see it's dead on the left, chlorotic in the middle, thriving on the right. The next slide is oats, dead on the left, thick with iron deficiency chlorosis, nickel toxicity in the middle, and forming seeds on the right. So that was, a very effective technology for this nickel-contaminated soil. Now I'm going to show you another idea, again, where the tailor-made approach is the solution. But again, it depends upon understanding phyto and bioavailability, why a site is barren. You know, although engineers do these jobs, the agronomy has to be taken into account. You can't ignore the agronomy and the fertility of a site and establish an effective cover that's going to persist and satisfy the regulations. This next slide, 83, describes the site that ERT and Michelle's shop asked me to help them with. It's near Eden and Lowell, Vermont. It is an asbestos mine waste deposit. They dug out rock, serpentine rock, rich in asbestos, sold the asbestos, and piled up the ground rock. You grind it and wash out the asbestos and recover the asbestos for sale. Well, you can imagine that might be a Superfund site today. It's been closed for a number of years, nearly 20 years, but it was barren almost from the first day they made a pile of ground rock, and it's unequivocally been barren since 1950. This rock is serpentinite rock. It's not carbonate rock or granite rock. It happens to be extremely infertile because it's magnesium silicate rock. So and because it's serpentinite, it's rich in natural levels of nickel and chromium and cobalt and this magnesium silicate. It's deficient in most plant nutrients, but it's severely calcium deficient or magnesium phytotoxic because there's almost no calcium in this rock. So whether it's calcium deficient, magnesium toxic, or whatever, it's not nickel toxic because of the high pH due to the magnesium silicate. The alternative that the Superfund program was considering is putting 2 feet of soil cover over 300 acres with some leveling. They're talking about a $200 million remediation. Obviously, that doesn't sound like a good and smart choice or a publicly wise choice. So we're looking at an in-situ remediation using the approaches that I've been describing where we deal with bioavailability, we use soil amendments and agronomic knowledge to solve the Superfund remediation need. Next slide, 84, is saying, again, what's wrong here? The high magnesium means we've got to have improvement in calcium. All the nutrients are deficient, particularly phosphorus. It's so severely deficient in phosphorus, nothing's going to grow. Matter of fact, even if this were a topsoil with fertilizers added, it would be unusual serpentine vegetation because of the low calcium and low phosphorus. You saw those other pictures. I'll show you more pictures in a second. High slopes of this ground rock waste, because it was rocky, it has a higher slope than one would otherwise have. So we looked at remediating it with no change in slope. And so we did an experiment to evaluate how to achieve this revegetation. The next slide, 85, is Belvedere Mountain. This is the mountain of a ground as serpentinite rock from this asbestos mine. This is the Vermont Asbestos Group mine waste site. The next slide is a smaller scale slide of some of the area. They did some local moving to stop transfer into the surface waters. Next slide is another, looking at one of these sides of this mountain of barren waste. The next slide is 88, is my treatments. Again, because we didn't expect them to be able to incorporate, particularly not on the slope, but even on the low side, rototilling is, let's say, it's somewhat difficult with rocky. if we could do a surface application remediation, that would be a choice. So we studied the control, and NPK fertilizer, which would be what they would use in attempting to remediate a barren site, short of the knowledge we have from Superfund studies. And then using a surface application of 2 inches of compost plus fertilizer, or compost plus fertilizer plus gypsum, versus an application of 2 inches of topsoil plus fertilizer. In this case, we purchased locally available compost, which was a mixture of manure, leaf, and other yard waste and other organic material that could be composted and make a saleable compost. We studied the plant species that are commonly used in revegetating roadsides and other sites in that part of Vermont. Next slide, 89, shows the response of tall fescue. On the left is the control. Control plus NPK, a little bit grew, but you can see it's much better with the compost. And the picture after that is perennial ryegrass, again, hardly living with NPK fertilizer, but lush with the compost application. The slide after that is the side-by-side, the compost plus gypsum treatment, which we think is the best long-term treatment for a site with such severe calcium deficiency. The next slide, 92, is Kentucky bluegrass. Again, hardly anything living, even with NPK fertilizer. But with a compost application, I provided all the nutrients in large amounts and the organic matter and the soil microbes. And then with the compost plus gypsum, I give it the extra calcium. So I end up then with lush vegetation. We looked at the rooting in these and in the controls. The rooting is just barely there on the controls, even with fertilizer. But we applied the compost, even though the compost is still sitting on the surface, the nutrients that leached allowed lush root exploration and deep rooting into the serpentinite mine waste. Slide after that is the alcyc clover. We think any of these sites need a legume in the mixture. And again, the compost plus gypsum is just a wonderful medium to cure this particular Superfund site. And there, the next slide is the side-by-side. On the left in the control, even where it did grow a little while, it's dying. We're lush and happy growth on the compost amended soil. Then we went up, the next slide shows going up and installing field test plots. A greenhouse study is nice, but you aren't going to convince the citizens with a greenhouse study. You may convince the company with a greenhouse study, and at least to put in a field test. So here we measured out the volume of compost, how many gallons of compost we needed to apply 2 inches on the plot. We applied the gypsum and the fertilizer and limestone to make the recommended remediation mixture. The next slide shows we mixed that up by hand, so we had an intimate mixture for the experiment. Used a bobcat to carry it up and put it on plots. You see flags and stakes there, and the team applying and then raking out. The next slide, 96, 98, is the plots laid out. They were then seeded, and you'll see that each one of these rows of plots has a control, which is fertilized and seeded, the same as the two different composts that we were using in the test. The slide after that, 99, shows a month later, it was a dry spell, and it didn't germinate as well as we might have hoped. As you see, we have vegetative cover, but the controls remain delightfully dead. Nice, remain dead, nothing is happening. In the background, you see what we called the opportunity plots. We had a lot of compost purchased and the gypsum and so on. We used all of the materials we had on hand and put in different tests on different slopes and different granular size around the site. Just trying, again, to test, you know, how well will this work besides on this smaller slope? How about on high slopes? I think anybody at a site like this, they had compost left over, would find a way to use it. The next slide is a close-up this spring, taken by our collaborator in Vermont, a guy named John Smeltzer with the DEC. You see, we've got not perfect. We're going to probably reseed these, but we've got a very effective cover compared to nothing growing at all on the control adjacent to it. The next slide is just beginning moving toward a summary. So how do we achieve success at this VAG Superfund site? We evaluated fertility problems. We understood the fertility of the of that waste soil material. Severe calcium deficiency and phosphorus deficiency makes it so nothing can grow there, no matter how hard you try otherwise. Chemicals might have done it, but then you wouldn't have had the living inoculum of organic matter and microbes from the compost. We tested it in advance in a greenhouse test so it would be we could work out whether the gypsum would be smart to use or maybe not needed. There might be enough calcium from the compost alone. Or it might be that it's enough more beneficial that we should go ahead and do that. And so by testing those things, that the next to the bottom line is that why did I add the limestone? If the soil is pH 8, why did I add limestone? Well, the organic layer on top will have oxidation of sulfur and nitrogen that came in the compost over time, which can acidify it and could make it more acid and would eventually perhaps make it not toxic to the cover. And the best way to prevent it from becoming acid is just put a little bit of limestone in. It doesn't take much limestone to make sure that it's going to be pH 7, again, 100 or 200 years from now. We added the gypsum in particular so that calcium would leach into the rock material, the ground rock, and alleviate the severe magnesium toxicity. If we do that, then the nutrients supplied to the roots that are in the organic layer will help grow the plants and give us much greater depth for water storage and availability to maintain the plant cover. Now, this site is not like Colorado or Idaho. It's not so severely dry. It's not a desert. But it does have adequate rainfall. So I don't have so severe of a problem if I alleviate the toxicity and deficiency. Next slide, just coming back to the last couple summary slides. As Mark said in the beginning, the whole process of remediation starts with risk assessment. We have to understand the risk, which is contingent upon bioavailability, which is contingent upon chemistry of the matrix and the chemistry of the treatments we can apply. We've done risk assessment and understand the fate and effects of metals in different media, so that soil-plant barrier, plant limitations of uptake that would cause food chain poisoning are important tools. But we also know that excessive lead, arsenic, fluoride, and so on in surface soil can poison wildlife that eat soil, so we have to deal with those when they're present. We always have to consider making a zinc, copper, nickel, manganese toxic site alkaline so it does not return to toxicity in the near future. We need to supply an organic amendment. And I won't say it's absolutely essential, but I think it's always cost effective. It gives an immediate response. The public if you ask the public and you showed them, it took 5 years to get decent vegetative cover if you didn't use a compost, and a month to have vegetative cover if you do use a compost, you know what they would tell you about using a compost. The compost also gives you the inoculum, and it's a very cheap inoculum, as well as a diverse fertilizer source. Any site that you've remediated has to support diverse plant growth. The ones that we want to plant, but then the ones that are going to take over, including trees in the future. And everything I've talked about is dealing to prevent future toxicity, not just today's, but future toxicity and nutrient deficiency that cause a site to be toxic. Slide 103 is just reminding you out there who are going to be doing this, hey, this is simple. Engineers can do this. All they got to do is read and use this knowledge, and then use your creative skills to apply all this knowledge to specific sites. That's engineering. And work with, you can ask EPA for advice. You can ask NRCS for advice. You can ask your local state university for advice. There's lots of ways to get information, as well as the website resources that Michelle Mahoney noted earlier. It is really an opportunity that has worked at site after site, slide 104. Everywhere we've tried it, it's been successful on zinc toxic, on copper toxic, on sites rich in lead. We used this on a lead mine site in Joplin, Missouri, that will be talked about more at the next site, where it was really a lead poisoning risk site. And we could use biosolid compost or phosphate to convert lead into non-bioavailable forms. So that, although I've dealt with that, there's going to be a lot more about bioavailability and bioaccessibility in that webinar on the 31st of August. the science is clear. It's a matter of applying that knowledge, and I hope that this webinar helps each of you believe that you can make it happen the same way that you saw it work so successfully here and at numerous sites now in Europe where they've applied this idea following the examples we provided in the U.S. So with that, I think we've done the slide, and we're back to dealing with any questions. Michelle, it's back to you.
Great. Thank you, Rufus. Yeah, and as Rufus mentioned, we are going to have a part two on this topic on August 31st, where we'll have Nick Basta from The Ohio State University and Kirk Shekel from EPA's Office of Research and Development. And they're going to talk about technical performance measures for amended soils and then also provide some information and experience of what they've had when soil amendments didn't really work the way that they expected them to. So you can register for that on iCLUIN.org. It's August 31st. So yes, Rufus, we have a number of questions that have come in. I guess I'll just start by reading them to you. And we do actually have Kirk and Nick on the line too. So if there's, if they have some insights on some of these questions, feel free to jump in, and you too, Mark. The first question we have, it came in early on in your presentation when you were talking about that it was important to improve and remediate the soil quality at these sites so that we could have legumes grow there. And this questioner wants to know if you could explain a little bit more of why legume growth is so necessary.
Okay. Legumes fix nitrogen from the air. And grasses and other plant species can only grow where there's nitrogen. I like to point out that the reason that a metal tolerant grass is not good enough solution by itself is you have to fertilize the site every year forever. And if we can do a one-shot stave revegetated treatment, that is a much wiser alternative. So we need the legumes, so we have to reduce metal toxicity enough so legumes can also thrive and keep providing nitrogen for the diverse vegetation that will occur there.
Okay. The next question that we got, this person wants to know if a heavy metal, can a heavy metal be dispersed or filtered out once it's composted? I guess maybe they're referring to once you add the biosolids, is it possible to disperse or filter out the metals?
Well, after you amend the site, remember that the biosolids has to comply with EPA rules. It is not toxic by itself. We use it to reverse the toxicity of existing contaminated site. That plus the limestone to help reduce the solubility of the metals at a site, and then the extra binding capacity added by the biosolids. Those will keep the metals from migrating from the site. In contrast with some claims you will find, if you look at long-term biosolids amended soils, unless the pH drops well below 5, there's hardly any movement of the metals. They stay in the surface soil. So they're part of the locking up metals mechanism of the remediation that we try to use with this tailor-made remediation mixture approach.
Okay. The next question we got, this person wants to know if you can give some more details about cadmium and selenium risks to human health as they relate to ingesting produce grown on contaminated soils.
The cadmium issue has to do with the sites where it's cadmium without zinc. There are a few places, say a nickel-cadmium battery factory pollution or a cadmium pigment manufacturer's pollution and so on, where there's cadmium without zinc. Usually there's 100 times more zinc than cadmium, so the plant is killed by zinc before there's even 5 ppm cadmium in the plant, and the zinc prevents it from being absorbed in the gut of the animal that eats the plant. So that garden vegetables are not dangerous than the usual 100-to-1, and that was proven in Palmerton, the lettuce grown on gardens in that city. On these other sites, or where there is rice being grown, rice takes up cadmium into the grain because it's grown in flooded soils. When you drain the soil, cadmium moves into the grain of rice, and people that eat homegrown rice have been poisoned in Asia in maybe 100 locations. So it's a very ugly situation. It's where nearly every human injured by cadmium, other than industrial exposure, has been poisoned. We don't have anybody poisoned by garden cadmium, only by the rice cadmium. Selenium is first known because it poisons wildlife and livestock. It's taken up more in alkaline soils, and it usually occurs naturally. But it also occurs where people have spread selenium-rich fly ash or coal ash. It happened again in China where people ate locally grown corn rather than rice and vegetables and were actually poisoned by selenium. We don't have any cases like that in the rest of the world that we know of, but we know that selenium can poison from the garden scenario, at least theoretically. So with high cadmium zinc ratio, the cadmium in soil can be dangerous. With high selenium or high molybdenum, high molybdenum can poison livestock or wildlife, but not people because people are not ruminants. We don't have the same risk from molybdenum. I think I've addressed that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next question we have, this person wants to know if they're, like, what is the thinnest layer of compost recommended? Is that actually something that do we normally throw out a number for that?
Well, it depends on the severity of the toxicity and infertility of the site. In the soil amendments booklet that's on the website, you'll see a discussion of why we use 2 inches or 1 inch in different studies. There are some areas that are only, let's say, somewhat contaminated and need more limestone, and some compost, maybe an inch is plenty. Other sites may be so severe of infertility or toxicity and the need for the sorbent that we'd recommend 2 inches so we get more of that leaching of alkalinity into the soil profile. If you can incorporate, that's always the first choice. Construction discs and so on can incorporate a foot or even 2 feet. The rototillers made for railroad roadbed construction and so on, or under road materials, where they actually rototill 2 feet of materials. Those are commercially available. We don't use them in agriculture. But again, it depends on how severe the toxicity and infertility are, whether you'd recommend 1 or 2 inches, and that is discussed in more detail in the soil amendment book.
Right. Yeah, and I guess this other question I'm going to read aloud, it's similarly related. This person wants to know, how do you make the right formula of soil amendment? Is there a resource guide available? And as Rufus mentioned, we do have our soil amendments paper that's on the EcoTools webpage that has tables of, you know, the contaminants that we have experience with and the types of soil amendments that have been used successfully to reduce their bioavailability and remediate those sites. And I guess as far as testing the right formula, that's when you try out different mixes in the greenhouse like Rufus was showing in his slides and then take it out to the field and see what works best.
Use a soil fertility analysis. You'd pay a soils testing lab to get the fertility information.
Right.
And then the toxicity information, again, TCLP doesn't mean anything in relation to remediation planning. That only has to do with landfill assignments. If you're going to look at in-situ remediation, you then need to know the phytoavailability of these contaminants. And DVA extraction is one method. That strontium nitrate or calcium nitrate extraction is another approach to learn how soluble the contaminants are. pH and the variation of pH across the site are key information to help you learn how bad you have to deal with the low pH making it toxic. But nearly every one of these sites that you saw us talk about are severely toxic, either because it was naturally acidic and metals got deposited on the site, or it had sulfide minerals in the waste and became extremely acidic. We showed you western Missouri and Idaho and Colorado sites with high sulfide. In eastern Missouri, there are sites that had a dolomitic lime waste that was very high in zinc and lead. That site was not metal toxic, it was just severely deficient and so low in organic matter and microbes that nothing could grow. And so it was useful maybe to incorporate some lime equivalent, but the organic matter, the microbial inoculum, and the fertilizer from manure or compost or biosolids was the perfect remedy to establish, again, a diverse vegetative cover immediately after mixing. And until you incorporated some amendment, it was just a barren pile of ground limestone rock.
Yeah.
So fertility, bioavailability assessment with a soluble metal kind of test gives you the information. The fertility guidance tells you whether you need certain fertilizers. That booklet gives you an overview of these ideas, and sometimes you have to get help or actually do experiments to test for yourself what is the most cost-effective way to do it. In the phosphorus side, sometimes you'll see people saying use rock phosphate. Well, rock phosphate is alkaline, and it is only slowly reactive compared to phosphate fertilizer, like triple superphosphate, in terms of reacting with lead or being plant available. So if you've got a severely P-deficient site, rock phosphate may not be the best choice. And if you need to look at the cadmium content of the phosphate fertilizer or rock, because some of the Western phosphates have enough cadmium, I wouldn't use those materials in remediation. But the Eastern phosphates are low and perfectly wise for use in remediation. Again, I mentioned you have to deal with agronomy. You can't just look at it as an engineer. That's part of the remediation of these kind of sites. And so you need to learn a little bit more so you can decide, based on the measurements you have in hand, what is the remediation amendments needed to achieve these outcomes.
Okay. Back to you. All right, we have quite a few more questions here, Rufus, so I'll just keep moving along. The next question, how does reducing the bioavailability of metals with amendments affect risk from direct ingestion of soil? And the other comment was, aside from just the plant cover reducing ingestion, or I guess exposure is what the questioner meant to ask.
Well, part of it is the chemical reactions of the desorbent activity. When you incorporate iron oxides, phosphate, you convert, for instance, you convert lead into chemical forms which are less and less bioavailable. When you add alkalinity and silicate and so on, you convert zinc, copper, nickel, cadmium, and other metals into less and less bioavailable forms because they convert to these lead double hydroxides and to metals that are within the iron oxide particles. And so they become actually less and less available over years after it's mixed. They have an immediate reaction, and then it gets less and less available in the next few years after the original mixing. So even ingestion of those become non-dangerous because you've converted it into non-bioavailable forms when ingested.
Okay. I just noticed that Nick Bosta made a comment. He also wanted to add to the person who asked that question, how do I determine the right mix for the amendments? And he just wanted to make the statement that you need to know what the risk driver is first, because the right soil amendment depends on the exposure pathway of concern. That's
toxic,
a good point.
Toxic item of concern.
Right, exactly. The next question we have, this person wants to know if there's any examples where you use soil amendments, you improve the vegetative cover, but then you created an attractive nuisance for wildlife, causing greater wildlife exposure and possibly risk.
That's one that we had to do research to make the proof that is needed to convince the public. Mark Springer worked on a couple of these sites and sampled wildlife, and there have been a collection of bones of hunters, collected animals, and so on to look for other evidence of risk. The reason that EPA and USDA can recommend this as an alternative remediation approach is because if you take into account all the issues raised, you convert the toxic elements in that mixture into non-bioavailable forms, that even if the soil is ingested or the animals eat 100% of their diet, they're not going to have risk. So it's the changing chemical forms and reducing bioavailability that allow that to be a successful remediation.
Right.
Michelle, I'll throw in that also that sure. there may be limitations, though, to where we may want to apply something at extremely high concentrations of some elements. We may, from a remediation standpoint, say, you know, that's just high enough that that particular spot, not the entire site, but that particular spot, maybe we need to do something a little bit different with that. You know, say if we're at 15,000 parts per million cadmium, we would not want to necessarily those kinds of concentrations. Okay. So
we're not saying we can remediate that with these simple amendments, but most of the sites are not 15,000 lead and 3,000 arsenic.
Correct.
Lead by less than 100 arsenic, and they can be remediated with iron oxide, or the less than 5,000 lead can be remediated with a phosphate approach.
Exactly.
Okay. Next question is related to gardening sites. They're developing a sampling plan for an urban community garden site. And they want to know if there's a table that details what we should include in their sample analysis or physical analysis of the soil and what applicable ranges they should look for beyond state and regulatory standards. I guess the one thing I'll mention is my office just recently put out a guide fact sheet for communities interested in gardening on potentially contaminated sites that provide you with some of the steps and things to think about. You know, what type of analysis you should think about doing based on what history you know about your site.
In most cases, we're trying to move toward using a bioaccessible lead measure or bioaccessible arsenic measure rather than total because, for instance, I'm getting a paper in a week in Italy showing that long-term Baltimore urban gardens at 3,000 ppm lead, it's as low as 2.5 to 5% bioavailable instead of 30% bioavailable. The long-term incorporation in gardens of organic matter and phosphate and the growing of crops, it changes the bioavailability of soil lead quite substantially. But until you make those measurements, you have to stand by the EPA 1,200 ppm lead in non-play areas for children's exposure, and then use this kind of bioaccessible lead measure to adjust the endpoint for putting remove or put in raised beds or abandon the site for use.
Right. I guess the other thing I'll mention, there is an interagency work group that's getting off the ground with EPA, ATSDR, USDA, FDA, and some others where we're starting to explore the data that's out there and how we could come up with some models for this gardening scenario because it's not the same as the hand-to-mouth scenario.
Although the hand-to-mouth is the most the highest risk for
right.
nearly everything. There's very
right.
few elements in the soil that would be a risk because the ones that are taken up by plants are very unusual contaminants.
Mm-hmm. Right. The next question we have, this person made the comment that your examples were of acid soils. What about alkaline soils? And they say, like the red mud and alumina plants?
The red mud and alumina plants have a different set of potential toxicities. And, I have to look at what's in it with you. But, actually, some people have studied using red mud to remediate metal toxic soils. It is very high in iron oxide, that's the red. It's high in alkalinity from the sodium hydroxide residue from extracting the aluminum from the aluminum ore to make the red mud. Commonly one would apply sulfur to get some acidification, bring it back down to maybe 7.5 to 8 pH, but then it's extremely infertile. And so the extremely low phosphorus availability because of the high iron oxide means that a compost application, and again, it's been killed by the chemical treatment of extracting the alumina, so it needs something like a compost to return it to fertility so you can establish vegetative cover. But alumina, that kind of waste is very easy to vegetate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What can you do to the soil which contains excess sodium?
Sodium is that special case. We call it sodic soil, where lots of agricultural land is sodic, and their standard method to deal with sodic soils, sodium-rich soils. What you do is you add calcium sulfate, gypsum, and irrigate. And the calcium aggregates the soil clays and pushes the sodium off the clay, and the sodium is then leached out of the topsoil. It's a standard protocol. If you look for remediation of sodic soils on the web, you'll find the USDA websites about sodic soils. They'll give you recipes and so on.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question that's similar to one I think we already addressed, but this person wanted to know if vegetative cover is an attractive nuisance. And, you know, we used to get this question a lot here in Superfund, and we actually put together a fact sheet to answer that question and how you can, work on determining if you are creating an attractive nuisance. And, Mark and Rufus have done a lot of work on this. I don't know if you have anything else to say on the topic, but I just wanted to let this person know that we do have a fact sheet out there that can help address any concerns with attractive nuisance.
I think the key is understanding that by reversing the toxicity, we grow healthy plants, and those healthy plants do not have enough zinc or copper or nickel or manganese and other elements to cause risk to the wildlife. The risk to the wildlife from the lead and arsenic would be through soil ingestion, and by converting those elements in the soil to less bioavailable forms, we only consider it done when the bioavailability is low enough that normal ingestion by wildlife would not cause harm to those wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So it may look like an attractive nuisance to some, but it's a nicely revegetated site that protects wildlife based on the science.
Right, and I guess the follow-up question I'll read next. This person says, Has anyone looked at the soil to earthworm to shrew robin pathway at these sites? And they also made a comment that it's a great presentation, so I thought I'd mention that. I don't know, Mark, if you had any insights on.
We've looked at that. That's been part of the risk assessments that we did and the evaluations. What we had done, and Rufus had alluded to, with some of the work we did a number of years ago, like California Gulch and out in Jasper County, we basically took our standard ecological risk assessment and used that as the tool to evaluate the residual risk. And those included earthworm accumulation studies. They included dietary exposure models to shrews and other organisms. And basically the overall conclusion was in the places where we tested and where we worked, putting at least one little hedge in there, we came up with acceptable exposures.
Again, when you convert the soil lead and other elements into forms that are not toxic to plants, it's no longer toxic to earthworms, and the normal soil ingestion by shrews or birds would similarly not have a toxic exposure. Again, as Mark said, if you go to these extremely contaminated sites, we're not saying that we can cure the extremely contaminated site, just damn near all the sites.
And one other thing with that, if you're interested in going and looking at the risk assessments, as we've sort of been saying, but not saying quite as explicitly, and especially if you're going into dietary exposure models, you can't use the bulk soil concentrations. If you use bulk soil concentrations in those exposure models, you will always conclude that there is unacceptable exposure. You have to go to the bioavailable fraction, the bioaccessibility.
Those can be very low after we've added iron and phosphorus.
Okay. Another question we got in is, how often do you have to apply a biosolid?
I try to describe that this is a one-shot approach, because when it's used, you do it and it becomes vegetated, or sometimes with bad weather you have to reseed, but it becomes vegetated and stable. The Palmerton site has remained stable almost 30 years now since it was originally treated in the field, and so on. If you take into account the fertilizer and the fertility needs and the toxicity remediation needs, you fix the site. And then it accumulates, actually, with plant growth and plant residues building up over time from the dead guy, you know, the plants that die every winter, you end up building the organic matter in the soil. Mm-hmm. And it becomes more, you know, more and more favorable and lower exposure potential over time. One shot. That's why we think it's so such a good choice. Remember I said you can't use just grasses and revegetate without dealing with the need to grow legumes because they have to fertilize it every year forever. So converting it to a one treatment and then the 5-year follow-ups to satisfy the EPA program until it's agreed that it is no longer a hazard and it's a self-sustaining ecosystem. That's our goal, self-sustaining ecosystem, not just a 5-year fix. Years ago.
Okay. I guess I'll follow up with this question we're getting from our colleagues in EPA Region 7. They're curious about how you measured success at Joplin, Missouri, because it's their understanding that after 3 years, the vegetative growth stalled, 5 years it disappeared, and they also stated that 50 tons per acre did not work.
Well, I'll go back to what Dr. Gary Przinski reported at several meetings. That is indeed what they found. And I'll say that if you don't deal with the infertility and toxicity, you end up not adequately fixing the site. That's why 2 inches or you sometimes perhaps even more are going to be needed. And it may need, again, a more biodegradable, so you mix, if you're not going to mix it in, then you've got to, it's got to have natural processes, move the alkalinity and some of the fertilizer nutrients into the surface soil depth. Other tests have been conducted by Hederachi at Kansas State using up to 100 tons rather than only 50 tons per acre, and those have remained vegetated. That was reported last year at a national meeting. So I think it was just, you know, if you don't apply enough, you don't shift the biological toxicity of the soil enough to establish the remediation that you need to achieve to have it be persistent. All these other sites I showed you are persistently fixed.
Okay. Well, here's a question. This person wants to know if there's a range of cost per acre for biosolid application. I know that there's some cost information in the soil amendments paper we keep mentioning that EPA put out, but I didn't know if you had any information that you want to share, Rufus.
I think I just refer people to that.
You're talking,
you know, at least several thousand dollars an acre to achieve persistent revegetation at one of these barren sites.
Right.
You can often reduce that by obtaining industrial byproducts at a low price or pay to take away. For instance, at the Bunker Hill site, the people had wood ash that they had to pay to put in a landfill.
Right.
Crazy, but that's what it was, and so they actually contributed funds to help with the hauling of biosolids from Seattle all the way to Bunker Hill because it saved them money to have their material consumed beneficially.
Okay.
And that's, again, that's part of the creative way to find to make these mixtures.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Most of the examples given during the seminar are from old mines or excavations. This person wants to know if you can apply soil amendments to urban areas and cities, and if so, what is the best mixture additive for soil contaminated by lead?
We have one paper from a study we did in Baltimore City using biosolids compost from Baltimore and showed a significant reduction in bioavailability, and of course then it was no longer bare dirt, it was well-vegetated grass. It reduced the bioaccessible lead below the levels, according to HUD and EPA, and was considered a successful vegetation remediation of that soil. Manure could do the same thing, particularly if it had an iron-rich byproduct mixed into it.
Okay. Another question we have is, are there guidelines to be used to indicate a remediation plan like this? And are there bioassays necessary?
Depending upon the, say, a Superfund site, you may have to do a greenhouse test or field demonstration, small test to convince all the involved parties that that is an appropriate remediation at that site. If the chemistry is clear and it's not such a severe site, then I think you can use the current available knowledge to choose the amendments and design your revegetation mixture based on chemical extractions alone. A bioaccessible extraction is a special extraction, not a total or not a plant-available extraction. It's a special extraction.
We're getting a question. Someone wants to know if you've tried something called basic oxygen furnace slag. They state that its pH is 11+, high in iron and also some zinc. And this person claims that in combination with biosolids and other amendments, it might be a good choice. And you see a lot of it around steel mills. Are you familiar with this product?
Yeah, I am. And there are several other steel slags, steel manufacturing slags, particularly the blast furnace slag. It's very high in calcium silicate and carbonate equivalent. There are some of the basic oxygen furnace slags which say they're made with some other mixture in making the steel, some specialty steel. And there may be enough of some other elements in that slag. So some of them are legally hazardous, so you've got to have an evaluation of some of these less widely demonstrated materials, whether they are acceptable. I've seen literature showing that a small fraction of BOF slag is legally hazardous, whereas much of it would be just like the other alkaline amendments I mentioned. They're very high in amorphous iron. They'd be very, combined with a high phosphate material, would be a wonderful remediation mixture.
Okay. Do you have any information on how well the soil fauna, such as earthworms, is recovered or reclaimed at sites? Is there any data on that?
Everywhere that we found we have plants growing, earthworms grow when they're put in the test. One of the problems with dealing with a toxic site, one of these severe, barren, large sites, is that worms have to crawl a long way to get to your plots. So if you don't inoculate them, you aren't going to have worms growing there. But where they've been tested, they've always shown effective earthworm growth and other soil fauna and flora thriving in the soils that have been remediated enough to support diverse vegetation, including legumes. That includes bacteria that are needed, the rhizobium bacteria needed to grow legumes. They survive very well on a site where the plant can actually grow. The plant is as sensitive or more sensitive to zinc than the microbe is. So yes, it effectively protects the soil organisms, all that have been tested, and we end up with all the different soil microbes needed to convert nutrients from one form to another so it has normal fertility.
So, Rufus, just to clarify, are you saying that the earthworms are coming back on their own, or you're inoculating them at sites?
That on these toxic sites, if you don't inoculate, it'll take a long time before they migrate back naturally. If you remediate up to the edge of the normal plants in the environment, they will colonize into your area as a new place to live. But if you're out in the middle of a dead area, you can choose to inoculate. You could actually have people make you a specialty compost that they put earthworms in while it's being cured, and you end up with an earthworm inoculum in the compost that you're using.
Right. Okay. Okay, we have someone here describing a site that they're working on. They have a two-part question. They say they've been working for many years at a historic gold mining site with high arsenic tailings, 3 to 4% by weight. Bioavailability tests on tailings indicate that arsenic calcinate-type forms are much, much more bioavailable than iron oxides, than what they say. It's 40% versus 8%. And currently, they have a 3-year research by multiple universities looking at possible remediation options. And then they have two questions. The first one is, Are there metals like arsenic whose bioavailability increases with higher pH? And then the second part is, would you approach a site where arsenic and cadmium are high but would require opposite approaches in soil amendments?
Well, let me address that. When you've got a site with more than 1% arsenic, you've got a site that's going to have to be, it's going to have to go to a landfill, or it's going to have significant cover. I don't believe that any regulatory authority I know of is going to allow that to remain the surface soil, because it will poison wildlife. Arsenic is not taken up by plants to the extent that it will poison food chain. It's eaten as ingested soil. If you're talking about, let's say, the Sutter's Mine areas in California, where you have maybe 300 to 1,000 ppm arsenic, those sites, particularly when they're very high in iron oxide, may have low enough bioavailability that can be a wildlife site, but it can't be a children's play area. Those are the kind of things you have to look at. Does it have to have no children being allowed there, or can it have wildlife? And is the bioavailability low enough that it will protect wildlife? Well, let's come back to the other question you asked about a site with multiple contamination, such that if you fix one, you cause the other to be worse. I want to describe a case that shows one of the most difficult mixtures, and that is molybdenum and copper or lead or zinc. Molybdenum and selenium are taken up much more at high pH. So if you raise the pH to counteract zinc or copper or nickel toxicity, and the molybdenum wasn't toxic initially in the vegetation, it might become toxic in the vegetation after you had limestone, if you make it calcareous the way that I've described for most sites as being effective for zinc, say zinc lead toxic sites. There's an in-between of leaving it at pH 7 and having enough iron that it reduces molybdenum plant availability and not growing legumes, because legumes take up a lot more molybdenum than grasses. So that there are some alternatives that avoid the molybdenum toxicity to the wildlife and livestock. Selenium would be the same kind of thing. If you had a very highly selenium contaminated site, it may be that you can't, if it's, say, also a zinc or some other, say, copper toxicity at the same time, it'd be very difficult to deal with both, because curing one makes the other a higher risk. Selenium, selenate, molybdate are higher risk at high pH, and when they're able to become the most toxic element there, then you've got to work around that toxicity by reducing bioavailability or not raising the pH so high and not having quite as favorable a remediation of zinc toxicity.
Okay, and it looks like we have one last question. What type of bioavailability test do you recommend prior to any remediation to see if there's even a need to remediate?
There's going to be a great deal about this in the talk on the 31st of August, but let me raise the main issues. There isn't a test using a 0.4 molar glycine at pH 1.5 that is an approved test of EPA's, but research at Joplin and other locations has shown that it does not reflect the reduction in bioavailability found by feeding remediated soils to human test subjects. At Joplin, we actually used phosphoric acid as one of the treatments and fed those soils to human volunteers. And the absorption in the blood of the humans was reduced by 69%, whereas the pH 1.5 method suggested it was only reduced in bioavailability by 19%. Doing the same extraction at pH 2.5, showed a reduction in bioavailability similar to that, I think 64%, similar to the human finding. So we believe that testing the bioaccessible lead using the pH 2.5, 0.4 molar glycine method is a useful, a meaningful method to assess bioaccessibility of soil lead to find out whether it's bad enough you need to deal with it. Remember I mentioned earlier that we found on these long-term garden soils that the lead bioavailability was far below the EPA assumption of 30%. 30% absolute bioavailability, as low as below 5%. And that would mean that you wouldn't have nearly as much soil to require remediation. It also can be done, testing can be done inexpensively. So you can test many samples from across the area and decide whether part of it needs remediate removal or treatment, and some of it is already low enough that it's that it would be safe for gardening and children exposure and garden use.
Right. Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have coming in, and we seem to have done almost perfectly on timing here. I want to thank you, Rufus and Mark, for your presentations. I'm already getting a bunch of very positive feedback from some emails here that I was looking at. And I'd like to encourage everyone on slide 105 of the presentation to click on the feedback form link and tell us what you thought. We use those ideas in developing future webinars and can, you know, also answer your questions if you think of things after the seminar is over. And another reminder, part two on this webinar series is on August 31st. I encourage you all to register. I know this one got waitlisted pretty early, so I'm hoping that you can join us then and look forward to continuing this conversation. So with that, thank you, and everyone have a great day, and I appreciate your attention. And Rufus and Mark, you did a great job.